But what is it that boys come back for time and time again? My soldiers, my infantry and cavalry and... Kathy could see he was fingering a wooden soldier even now, just beneath the line of a table. This one was so much more striking than any she had seen. Noble and distinguished. Imperial, somehow. Take all the attention you like, you scoundrel. Because if it wasn't for all those weeks and months I spent with my soldiers, why, there'd hardly be a roof above our head. You overestimate things, little brother. Your soldiers, they're commendable little things, but it's hardly an act of toy-making, is it? No, it's rather a form of carpentry, wouldn't you say? He said toy-making like another man might say enchantment. He said carpentry like another man might describe his morning ablutions. Kathy saw the way it made Emil shudder. The younger Godman brother brought his fist up from beneath the table and planted this new soldier on the surface, to stand proudly among the dumplings and dishes. We'll begin again, Caspar. Victor takes all, act of God or no. Caspar was still reclining as he weighed up the challenge. That's the spirit, little brother. He stood. Miss Ray, you'll have to excuse me. My brother has asked for a flogging. He was gesturing for Emil to lead the way. Caspar Godman was nothing if not a gentleman, when he had a sudden thought. Or perhaps you might like to watch. Moments later, she was looking over a battlefield in a bedroom above. She took it for Caspar's because a single paper tree stood in the corner, and she doubted this was something to which Emil wanted to wake each morning. The bed had been pushed against the outer wall, candles had been lit, and hillsides and forests sculpted perfectly in sponge and clay were being arranged according to rules only Caspar and Emil seemed to know. Next, each brother took a turn to line up his soldiers. Caspar's, Kathy saw, did not have the polish that belonged to Emil's. Some of them were replicas made by shop hands and sold across the shop floor, but even those that Caspar had evidently crafted himself did not live up to Emil's designs. Their faces betrayed little emotion, their eyes did not glimmer with the story of a life hard-lived, a war being desperately fought. They were mere playthings next to the Imperial Capitan that Emil so proudly placed at the head of his phalanx. Between each deployment, the silence stretched out. Once, Kathy tried to venture a word, but Caspar gave her a grin and begged her to remain quiet. So her eyes wandered instead. She was standing beside a tall glass cabinet, and in it stood toy soldiers very different from the ones Caspar and Emil were winding up. These only looked like soldiers at all in a certain light. They were made out of pine cone and pieces of bark, bound up with bootlaces and string and dead grass. She was still staring at them while Caspar and Emil's game got underway. Through the glass, those little faces etched and burnt into the bark gave the impression that they too were watching the battle. She could see the conflict being reflected in miniature. Caspar's expeditionary force had already been routed. Emil had wind up cavalry poised to shatter his flanks. She turned just in time to see them rolling down one of the hills. The joy on Emil's face reached a zenith, but then exploded, for he had not seen Caspar's reserves marching in from beneath the first bed. With his cavalry divided, Emil's soldiers were easily scattered. Those who survived the onslaught walked on, only to be upended when they reached the skirting board that ran around the edges of the room, a pile of pillows in place of a mountain. Finally, only the Imperial Capitan, weighted more heavily than the rest, remained. "Do you concede?" With his bottom lip bulging, Emil strode out of the room. For a moment, Caspar held himself as if victorious. Then the cost of the victory appeared to him, and heaving a sigh he loped to the door. "Emil!" For a moment he disappeared into the hall, and Kathy listened out for the clattering of footsteps. "Emil, I didn't mean to—" But the words petered out, and then Caspar was back in the room. His face was missing its customary smile. "I'm sorry," he said. "That's just Emil." "Oh, I wouldn't be so sure. I think you may have had little to do with it." Caspar had got to his knees to sweep the battlefield clear, lining up Emil's fallen soldiers with his own. Most had wound down, only one or two still kicked feebly in their death throes. I'll admit it, I've been being sore with him. But he takes his soldiers so seriously. He most likely think me frightful, and yet... he's my little brother. He pains me, but it doesn't mean I don't... It was a rotten trick, Casper, the way you baited him back at the table. It wasn't... honourable. No? It isn't how a family treats itself. Casper appeared to find this sentiment intriguing. Well, what about your family, Miss Ray? How do they treat you that you should run away to live in our emporium? I never said I ran away. Oh, Kathy, you say it every time you close your mouth. You say it every time you try so hard not to say it. He stopped. You'll tell me soon enough. I don't see why you try so hard to keep a secret you're so desperate to tell. But Kathy was practiced at silences. And when this one went on too long, Casper had to find another way to fill it. You think we're fools, don't you? To care so much about a game of soldiers. No, said Kathy, and something drew her eyes back to the pine cone figurines trapped behind the cabinet glass. No. Because I think there's something more to it than a game. She paused as if willing Casper to enter the silence. I'm right, aren't I? With you and Emile, it isn't just a game, it's... life, of a sort. Casper breathed out, as if trying to form a word, but no word came. It was, Kathy decided, the first unrehearsed reaction she had seen in him since the moment they'd met. You oughtn't to grind your brother into the dirt like that. Miss Ray, you misunderstand. You might not believe it, but there was a time before all this. Before the aisles and atriums, before any toys at all. You look at it now and you imagine the Emporium our entire world. Well, before the Emporium it was just us, the brothers Godman, without even our papa to call our own. We were each other's world back then. I'd do anything for Emile, and Emile for me too, though... And here Casper could not stop himself from smirking, for the joke was too perfect to resist. That was generally because I'd have told him to do it. When you see Emile get upset, it's only because he cares so much about this long war of ours. It's true what you say, Kathy. It isn't just a game, it's... who we are. He went to the door and peered out. When he was certain that the coast was clear, he looked back, and only then did he say, "The long war has been going on since the very first day we met our papa. Back then, if you can picture it, we weren't the sorts of boys who had toys. That came much later, once our papa started to teach us all of the things that he'd learned. No, don't look at me like that. It's you who wanted to know." He paused. "You do want to know, don't you?" Kathy nodded. "It was a long story," he said, "but he would tell it if that was what she wanted." And it started with these. He took her back to the cabinet, where the pinecone figurines had been watching, unmoved. "I was 8 years old the day I first saw these. They came flurrying out of the backwoods, a thin column carried by the wind, and my papa walking behind them like they were his guards. That was the first time I'd seen him in anything other than a picture. That was the day the Emporium was born." Picture it, if you would. Casper Godman is 8 years old, dishevelled as all the village children with whom he spends his days. Most of them are simple, certainly too simple for Casper, who has had an inkling ever since he can remember that he is more intelligent than them. A supposition borne out by the way he can ordinarily get them to do whatever he pleases, whether that be stealing hen's eggs, raiding the rock pools for crabs, or else taking a beating more properly meant for Casper himself. Yes, Casper has had the village children trained since before most of them could talk. He runs rings around them like a sheepdog to its sheep, and the only one who ever resists is the one they call Emile. Which is a terrible shame, because Emile is Casper's brother, and has been Casper's to look after ever since the day he was born. On this particular day, Casper has grown bored, and is following one of the lesser trails to the headland overlooking the village. From here he can see every house in Cernikava. All of the trails that converge out of the woods, the way the river Gauja broadens and deepens in colour as it joins with the sea. As he comes between the trees, he hears noises in the roots around him. Determined that it can only be Emil following in his footfall, he finds a hiding place beneath an overhang of earth. There, squatting with the woodlice and worms, he waits. But it is not Emil who has been following him out of the undergrowth. Instead, there come a procession of little figures, carried along on the wind. At first they are formless, but then he sees the twigs as arms, the briars that bind them, ringlets of leaves, and pine cones for heads. These are stick soldiers, and the wind gives them the appearance of marching. Temptation is a terrible thing for an 8-year-old boy. Before Caspar has any thought to deny himself, he darts out to scoop up a soldier, and he is standing there, turning that bundle in his hands, when a heavier tread comes along the track. He looks up into encroaching shadow and sees a vagrant lurching toward him. In his fists, their nails, like horns, are yet more soldiers. He is reaching into his pockets and casting them into the wind. When he sees Caspar, he stops. Cernikava is used to wayfarers. They tramp the roads of the coast, living off forage and the kindness of strangers. But this wayfarer is more brutish than most. His face is a lattice of scars, his nose misshapen, what teeth he has are rotted to pits, and all of that is hidden behind a beard so matted he might be part of the undergrowth itself. Caspar turns tail and flees, out of the trees, down the escarpments, toward the coast, holding the little pinecone soldier all the way. Intermittently he looks back. The vagrant is following after, but he has not changed the pace of his tread. He lumbers like a man who has come too far already, who would be happy to find a ditch and lie down until sleep takes him away. Caspar reaches home, that succession of wooden shacks, and scrambles inside to find his brother Emil leafing through the pages of a book, though neither Godman brother has ever learned to read. What is it? There's a wild man coming out of the woods. The door flies open, and there stands the very same vagrant. Emil leaps to his feet, cowers behind Caspar. Among all of the many things he is, Caspar is first of all Emil's big brother and would do anything to defend him. Which one of you is Caspar? This is not a man used to talking. His voice is of whispers and wind. I am, Caspar says defiant.
Where is your mamma?
My mamma is dead, he declares. 2 winters gone. Only this gives the vagrant pause. Behind his mask of filth he is quivering, and the only sign of his tears are the patches of pink skin that emerge out of the dark.
Then who looks after you boys?
We look after each other, declares Caspar, and we don't need nobody else.
Well, says the vagrant, and his voice is different now, less bestial somehow, though equally deranged. You have me now. I'm your papa, and I need to sleep.
Somehow, he knows where the old bedroom is, the one where Caspar and Emil's mamma had lain down to die. He crosses the shack and closes the door behind him, leaving only that coat of badly butchered hide behind. Seconds later, and for long hours to come, the sounds of his snoring reverberate in the house.
What now? Whispers Emil.
I think we sleep in the hen hut tonight, little brother. And that was exactly what they did, though there was precious little sleep to come. For that was the night that Caspar and Emil waged the opening battle of the Long War. After dark, they stole back into the shack where this man who claimed to be their blood was sleeping, and found the interloper's overcoat pockets stuffed full with pinecone soldiers, ballerinas of bark, war horses the size of thimbles. Caspar took a handful, Emil took a handful, and out back, where the yard dog barked and the hens clucked anxiously at the suggestion of every fox, they played out the first skirmish in the campaign Cathy had just watched.
It wasn't long after that we left, said Caspar, taking care as he balanced one of the pinecone figurines upon Cathy's palm. Papa spent a few days scrubbing himself clean. He butchered every hen in our hen hut, ate every egg in the nests, quartered the piglets and smoked hard sausages on a pyre. We didn't know it then, we thought he was just an animal, but he was fattening himself up. Until then he'd been skin and bone. It had taken him 2 years to walk home. He'd crossed all the rushes, but he wasn't stopping now. He wanted to carry on west, and he wanted us to come with him.
And you went, just like that.
Casper nodded. It wasn't just because he told us to, and it wasn't just because of those soldiers he made. But Miss Ray, he could have led all the village children away, if that was what he wanted. No, it was something in his eyes. Somebody needed to look after him. Emil and me, we decided that was us.
What about your dog, the one in the yard?
Left to go feral. Took us an age to forgive Papa for that. But he made it up to us once we'd reached London. You've already seen Sirius, the first of all the Emporium patchwork dogs, tramping up and down on its cotton wad paws. It was a long voyage. I must have held Emil's hand halfway around the world. Then we were in London, and our Papa showing us how to make toys. But that, he smiled, is another story. I'll tell you it sometime, but first... Isn't there something you want to tell me? Kathy realized she'd been staring at the soldier pirouetting in her palm for too long. Now Casper's hand had closed over it, and she was forced to look up into his eyes. They were imploring her to tell. Every moment she remained with his hand touching hers, more and more of her wanted to say, "Casper, it isn't so easy. Your story, it's full of adventure. Mine..." She might have said more. Her tongue was threatening to. But before she could, the bedroom door opened and Emil reappeared. He was comporting himself with more dignity than the moment he'd left, though his eyes were still swollen and raw. In his hands were more wooden soldiers. These ones were roughly hewn, still bearing the marks of his workshop lathe. But there was something magnificent in their minutely sculpted faces as well. Once painted, this would be a unit of men of the same standing as the Imperial Capitan. "I declare an ambush," Emil announced. Then, when Casper's eyes narrowed in an attempt to send him away, he sputtered. "It's within the rules. Your troops have taken mine as prisoners. My reinforcements arrive late and ambush them on the way." Those rules had been codified long before, and it took Casper too long to conjure up a reason why the battle had to wait. By then, Kathy had already taken her hand out of his and was hurrying away. "Wait!" called Casper. In the doorway, pushing past Emil, she stalled. "What are you doing on Christmas Day?"
"Christmas Day?"
It would be a lie to say she had not thought about it. Christmases at home lingered long in the imagination. The pre-dawn stampede down the stairs, the stories of the night before... The incomparable delight of contemplating presents under the tree and remembering how it felt when you were 5, 6, 7 years old. Distance might have dulled the pain that she felt. It had only amplified the longing.
"There's the banquet," Casper said. "The Emporium feast for all of the shopkeepers who can't go home. All of the sweepers and joiners and tinkers, and all of us godmans."
Kathy faltered in what she meant to say. So instead she asked...
"Where?"
"On the shop floor." Before she left, Kathy gave Casper a look that might have been either promise or regret. 5 days would pass between this midwinter's eve and the Christmas Day when he would find out for certain. He would spend every one of them chasing down the meaning in her eyes, and every night he would lose another battle to Emil. And in that way the long war would continue, while a new war was being waged in Casper Godman's mind. On Christmas morning, Kathy woke ravenous with the dawn. Sally Ann, she had discovered, had been secretly meeting with John Horwood, the Emporium caretaker, and he had taken her to a hotel for the evening. Ted Jacobs and Kesey and little Douglas Flood had ventured out into London as well, to go a-wassailing, see their families, or else lose themselves in some uproarious drinking den. The Emporium halls would be quiet without them. She rolled over with her hands to her belly, trying to assure herself that she was not truly alone. And yet, Christmas morning only intensified the feeling. Without Sally Ann to fill her head with gossip from the shop floor, she felt the absence of her mother more keenly than ever. There were things she wanted to ask. Was it normal to wake up in the night and rush to the toilet bowl barely to squeeze out a drop? Was it normal for her breasts to feel hard and tender all at the same time? For the skin around her nipples to darken with tiny raised bumps? She asked the baby all of these things, but when even the answers she invented stopped coming, she knew there was only one option. Sooner or later, she was going to have to leave the room. Sometime later, she picked her way down the shifting emporium stairs, and there, on the shop floor, lay everything Casper had spoken of. In the night, the shelves had been rearranged, opening a huge plateau between the exhibits. Through the paper trees, now shimmering in streamers, a huge table was being laid. Mrs. Hornung was directing the remaining shophands like a general with his men. Somebody was bringing out steaming platters of potatoes and parsnips. Somebody else was carving a goose. Even up high, the smells reached out and wrapped around her, tempting her down. When she came along the aisle and entered the plateau, one of the shop girls called out her name, and soon Kathy found herself laying out miniature wreaths of holly upon each plate. As soon as she had finished, a gong rang out. There must have been 30 shophands left in the emporium this Christmas day, and now they all scrabbled for their seats. Only then did Kathy see the Godmans were already among them. Papa Jack had a preordained seat at the head of the table. Somebody had hewn off its arms so that he could sit overhanging each side. But Casper had found a seat a little further along, pressed up between one of the archivists, a girl with bottle-green eyes, and one of the boys who wrangled the puppets. Both seemed to be vying for his attention. When he looked up, he seemed to stare straight through her, preferring their flirtation instead. Later, Kathy would put it down to the steam billowing up from the food, but she felt herself flushing crimson as the blood rushed to her cheeks. Sirius, the patchwork dog, appeared, as if to beg for scraps from the table, and then wandered on. Even he seemed to be drawn to Casper's company, curling up at his feet. She was still staring at him when she realized that the figure levering into the chair beside her was Emile. Food materialized upon her plate, but in comparison to the mountain on Emile's, hers was only a foothill. Even so, the baby inside her began to cavort. She could barely restrain her hands as Papa Jack rose at the head of the table to wish good cheer on all of his guests. "We haven't seen you," Emile whispered as his father raised a glass to another Emporium Christmas. Another dark winter shot through with Emporium lights. "I thought perhaps my brother had..." "No," said Kathy, "nothing like that. So you're... I'm well, Emile, I promise." She looked up to see him nodding feverishly. "I knew you were. My brother, sometimes he gets carried away. He thinks everyone ought to worship him. This time it's those trees. I'd be sore as all hell if only they weren't so good. And they are good, Kathy. That's the problem. When I saw what he'd done with those trees, why, I..." Kathy did not need him to finish the sentence. She had seen the look on Emile's face as his axe burst through the tree. There had been envy, that much was true, but eclipsing it was sheer delight. "I've been trying seasons to work something quite as magical. And Papa... Papa must have noticed. If it wasn't for my soldiers, why, the game would already be up. Papa might as well have signed the Emporium to Casper and be..." At the head of the table, Papa Jack was finishing his first toast. As the cheer went up, Emile lost track of his thoughts, and by the time the cheering died away, was rambling incoherent. "You didn't want to go home?" he finally asked, by way of stemming the tide. "No." "And your family, won't they miss you?" She wondered what the house was like today, whether there had been presents and celebrations or... "No," she whispered, half trying to convince herself. Somewhere in the conversation, as the first food touched her lips, she felt the baby twirling in unconstrained delight, and by instinct, her hand dropped to the curve of her belly to feel for it there. She was aware how tight her stomach felt, was marvelling at the way she filled even Sally Ann's clothes, when suddenly something pushed back against her hand. She froze, but the sensation came again, and when she lifted her hand, she could see it there, pushed up through fabric and flesh, a hand or a foot, the touch of her child.
She felt for it with the tip of her finger. Startled, the baby withdrew. Then, its courage returned, it kicked out again. In the corner of her eye, she saw Emil tense. In an instant, reality returned. The cheering from Papa Jack's toast reached a crescendo, and when she looked up, Emil was staring at the place where her fingers had been, his face livid as a bruise. Emil? Kathy, surely you can't be... Emil, she said, and was surprised to hear how easily her own voice frayed. Please. By now his face was buried in his food. Now he could not bear to look. And inside her, oblivious to its discovery, the baby continued to turn. Stowaway. Papa Jack's Emporium, 1907. Consider Emil Goodman, the youngest son of a youngest son, born to a toymaker who did not yet know that he was a toymaker, to a man who would one day find ways to invent whole worlds. On Christmas night, if you were the kind of creature to spy on him through a crack in the skirting boards, you would have found Emil in his workshop, tinkering with the toy held fast in the vise. He had been coming back to this toy for many long months, each time unable to make the adjustments that might have seen it taking pride of place on the shop floor. Something to transform the season. Something to strike all mention of those instant trees from the Emporium record. Something, anything, to stand alongside the magics with which his father and now his brother were imbuing their toys. It was a mahogany case, lined in velvet, and when he opened it up, it was to reveal... And when he opened it up, it was to reveal a family of mice dressed as ballerinas. He wound them up, daring to believe that when the mice unhitched themselves from the contraption and lined up in formation... But when the music tinkled and the dancing began, everything was wrong. When the lead mouse turned a pirouette, she tumbled into the dancers behind her. When the second held an arabesque, she promptly fell over. When it came time for the climactic move, the whole troop turning their torsion lair, the result was a chaos of arms and legs and tails, little grey legs windmilling madly in a heap on the tabletop. Emil whipped them all up and set them back in the vise. He was about to take another turn, but something stopped him. At first he thought it was his hands, treacherous as they were. He looked at them with fire. For why couldn't they be the ones plucking magic from thin air, taking the runners off a rocking horse and letting that horse go, cantering around the store? Then he realized it wasn't his hands at all. It was his head. His head was too busy, too clouded with other things. How could he be expected to achieve real magic when his heart wasn't in toy-making at all? It was the girl. After what he had seen at the Christmas table, he couldn't stop thinking about the girl. Christmas night came, and Emil breathed not a word. Boxing Day died, and still Papa Jack had not come knocking at Kathy's door, demanding to know why she had not told them she was conjuring a baby beneath their roof. Next morning, as the shop hands prepared the Emporium to open once more, there were no whispers in the palace, no sordid looks from Sally Ann and the rest. Doubting herself, Kathy ventured to the foot of the Goodman's stair, thinking she might catch him coming down, but Emil was already out, and soon the patchwork dog appeared to warn her away with its stuffed pillow barks. There was a deluge directly after Christmas Day, but the Emporium halls were never as busy again as they had been in December's earliest days. Kathy worked the register, or took children on rocking horse rides up and down the aisles while the Emporium stable hands looked dutifully on. And by New Year she was courageous enough to return to the palace each evening. By the end of that week she was beginning to feel that she was mistaken, that Emil hadn't really seen what he'd seen at all. In fact, as the second week in January arrived, and with it fresh flurries of London snow, she was finally starting to feel safe. Safety was a feeling that crept up on you. It was not like anxiety or fear. Safety did not descend in a rush, nor seize you in its hands. But here it was, all the same. A secret shared was a secret halved,
and Kathy might even have convinced herself to confide in others, to take one of the more seasoned girls to one side and confess. If only Sally Ann hadn't sashayed into the palace one morning, stopped the breakfast revelries — Douglas Flood insisted on playing his fiddle even at breakfast — and demanded everyone's attention. "Time to pack your cases, ladies, gentlemen," she declared, with a sad, lilting tone. At once, the shop hands understood. Kathy followed their gazes to where Sally Ann was now standing, up on the dais. In her hands was a single white flower, the hanging bell of a snowdrop plucked from the Emporium terrace. The thaw had come. This day at the Emporium would be the season's last. The Emporium closed its doors on a frigid January morning, London encrusted in frost. Mrs. Hornung had prepared great cauldrons of stewed apples to see the shop hands on their way, but aside from this there was no ceremony. Papa Jack did not emerge from his workshop. Emile and Caspar barely ghosted past. By the time Kathy was done packing what few possessions she had, most of the shop hands were already gone. She wound her way slowly to the shop floor, already denuded of last season's toys, and stood at the open doors, feeling the bracing chill of the London air.
"You'll be back next year, dear," said Mrs. Hornung.
"I will," Kathy lied, and went on with both hearts beating wild. At the end of Iron Duke Mews, Sally Ann scurried past her, whispered, "Good luck," and climbed into a taxicab her gentleman had sent to spirit her away. Then Kathy was alone, and London seemed suddenly so vast and unknown. The Emporium had looked after her for a time. Emile had looked after her by saying nothing, ever since the feast on Christmas Day. Now there had to be another way. She supposed that the Emporium was looking after her still, for there was a secret place in her satchel where all her winter money pay had been stashed. If she was careful, it would see her until spring. But spring would bring with it new life in more ways than one, and it was a long time until this New Year's first frost and the Emporium's reopening. How different life would be by then. She set off into the great unknown. Decisions like this should not be made on an instant. And yet, that was what she was doing, deciding her child's future at every intersection of roads, mapping out its life story by gravitating toward one tram stop or the next. Without knowing it, she reached Regent Street, where horse-drawn trams and trolley buses battled for control of the thoroughfare. North or south was the decision she had to make. The wind was coming from the north, so south it was. It took her some time to find a bus bound for Lambeth and Camberwell beyond. Those places seemed as likely as any. Sally Ann had spoken of grand houses along the Brixton Road, carved up into tinier apartments for city clerks and railway workers. One of those might do for ushering her baby into the world. The question of what happened next was one she was steadfastly putting to the back of her mind. The bus was slow in wending its way south. Kathy took a seat on the lower deck where the windows were fogged by the cold, and London was a ghostly miasma through the glass. They had not yet reached the circus at Piccadilly when she felt somebody sitting down beside her. Though she kept her head down, she could sense that the stranger had turned in her direction. He was sitting uncomfortably close, his eyes roaming all over her face, her hair, her belly. Finally, she could bear it no longer. She looked up, determined to dress him down. She would rather be thought hysterical than stomach his scrutiny a moment longer. And there sat Caspar Godman, looking half affronted that she had not noticed him sooner. "And where do you think you're going?"
"Caspar, what are you...
You didn't think to say goodbye?"
"The Emporium's closed, Caspar," she said, quickly reordering her thoughts. "Everybody left."
"So where are you going?" The bus had stopped while yet more passengers piled aboard. She searched for something to say, but each lie evaporated before she could give it voice. "I don't know," she finally admitted.
"Didn't you think about that before?" Before he had finished, she cut in. "What are you doing here, Caspar?"
"Me?
doesn't look right, you being out of the Emporium. It's like seeing a swallow in winter.
Casper's face creased. Miss Ray, he said as his laughter subsided. Why didn't you tell me?
The words did not flay her as she had thought that they might. Emile.
Don't blame Emile. The way he's been moping around, I knew something was wrong. And when I found all those snowdrops hung up to dry in his workshop, well, it takes a lot for Emile to break the rules. He'd been plucking them, you see, every morning for the last week. Seems he didn't want the season to finish, that he didn't want someone to go. By God, I thought he'd fallen in love. There he was, mooning after one of the seamstresses, or... It was just rotten luck that Sally Ann got to the terrace before him this morning. No doubt he'd have plucked every snowdrop until spring. Tried to keep the Emporium open until the rural gardens are in full flower. So he had to tell me, you see. The idea I'd tell our father what he'd been up to. The bus was about to take off again, but Casper cried out for the horseman to stop and extended a hand. Cathy Ray, don't make me be a gentleman in front of so many rabid onlookers. But you can't possibly think I'd let you, both, just wander off like that, can you? Back at the Emporium, the shop floor was in silence. The gloom that had settled was almost subterranean, and what one light broke in from the skylights above could hardly penetrate the aisles. Casper brought Cathy in through one of the tradesmen's doors, and now they stood in an alcove where pop-up books thronged the shelves. Each one of them held new delights, each page a cascade that could reach out and envelop its reader in lost worlds of dinosaurs and mammoths, of desert islands infested by cannibal hags, of fog-bound London streets and lonely fenland lochs. Mrs. Hornung had already begun laying out the dust sheets, hiding the exhibits for another season. Casper made Cathy wait until he had scouted the aisle ahead, and only then did he usher her on. Through the labyrinthine aisles they reached the paper forest and the Wendy house at its end. As Cathy passed under the branches, Casper lifted more Emporium instant trees from the shelving and cast them onto the floor. Just in case, he grinned, barely flinching as they erupted out of the ground behind him. Now that the Wendy house was entirely encircled, it could barely be seen from the aisle beyond. He took her over the white picket fence and walked within. Cathy stopped dead. You've been planning this for me. Things had changed since the last time she was here. Beside the bed stood a cradle. Beside that, a Russian rocking horse had been draped in blankets and shawls. A miniature kitchen had been arranged, with a gas-fired hot plate, a kettle, and a single casserole dish burnt black around the edges. The rack above was filled with jars of preserves, flour, and lard. "Everything I could snatch from the kitchen without Mrs. Hornung beginning to suspect," said Casper, turning a two-step across the carpeted expanse.
"I'm going to live here."
"Why not?" This seemed so obvious to him. "It has everything you could need. Not a soul on the shop floor could see. And the walls, well, Papa made them so that a horde of children could play inside, and barely a whisper would be heard without. There are three things a woman needs, Cathy. A roof over her head, food on her plate, and delightful company. 1, 2, 3. At the last, he turned his index finger on himself.
You haven't told Emile? Nor Papa Jack?
Strictly speaking, of course, it is against the rules. Emile could be a stickler, and my papa may not understand. Ever since that unfortunate business with that toy maker off the Portobello Road... Well, he's seen ghosts in every corner. I'm not suggesting he'll think you're a thief, but he may think you're in a thief's employ. What better ruse than a girl with child come to prey on our sympathies? You're making fun of me.
Cathy, he said more earnestly now, you can be safe here. You don't really want to have your baby alone in some Lambeth lodging, do you?
She shook her head. Well, you don't have to. All you need is here. Let the Wendy house be a sanctuary for you. Let these walls hide you away. Why, all you'll ever have to do is lock that door and nobody would ever find you. My papa never made a toy that would stoop so low as to break in all of his life. These walls are a fortress.
The Emporium might cave in and you'd still be snug and safe in here. His next words were not so full of bravado.
Let me do this, he whispered,
and then full of bravado again. Why would you ever want anywhere else?
Why indeed?
After Casper was gone, Kathy walked the circumference of the Wendy House walls. Here was an entire life in miniature. She would have been lying if she had said she was not afraid. It would not have been true to say she did not wonder why. But above everything else was the relief she felt as she rushed to grill bread over the hot plate and slathered it with elderflower preserve. Casper's footsteps were fading on the other side of the paper trees, and Kathy Ray broke into the most mystified smile. He came back to her that night, when the eerie hooting of the stuffed owls on the shop floor was keeping her awake. He had brought blackouts for the windows, so you can light your lantern at night, and extra blankets for the bed. The snowdrops might have flowered, but winter was still bitter and deep. He had brought tea leaves as well, and soup from Mrs. Hornung's pot. And, you're going to be bored, he said, so you might tutor yourselves with these. Onto the bedside, he upended a Hessian bag filled with pamphlets and old lithographs. Every catalogue and advertisement the Emporium's ever had. It's my own collection. One year we're going to have an exhibit devoted to it. Casper Godman's Archive of the Emporium. Here, he went on, rifling through to find the oldest one. What do you make of that? The card depicted stuffed bears of dubious design. Above it were the words, Come to Papa's Emporium. That's my handiwork you're holding there. I'll wager you didn't know you were in the presence of an artiste par excellence. When she did not challenge him, he added, I was 8 years old. It was the same month that my papa made this. Casper whistled, and into the Wendy house lolloped Sirius, the patchwork dog. On seeing Casper, it butted affectionately against his leg, as energetic as a concoction made up of fabric and thread could be. Then Casper crouched, and in teasing its ear, directed its gaze at Kathy. Do you understand? In response, the dog lay down at Kathy's feet. He's to keep you company, for when I can't be here. Oh, I'll come as often as I can, but there's a meal to think of, and Papa too. They'll expect me to be up in the workshop working out designs for next winter. If they don't see me slaving at it, they'll suspect. Kathy crouched so that the dog could nuzzle her hand. She still had no sense how such a thing might work, but the more time she spent with it, the less it seemed to matter. Such was the magic of an Emporium toy. Papa made him for us, to remind us of the dog we left behind. It was the winter we first came. We were living, all three of us, to a single room in one of those Whitechapel tenements a good girl like you won't know anything about. Papa didn't speak back then. He didn't really have the words, but he was making us those soldiers out of wood, and we were playing our long war. And then, one night, Emil was crying, and I was there, holding him, asking what was wrong. That was what it was like back then. Emil would crawl over in the night, and I'd have to hold him, tell him we were on the greatest adventure of our lives. And when he said he'd been thinking of our old dog, well, that got me sobbing too. I'd imagine you'd find that hard to believe. Me, Casper Godman, crying like that. Well, there was something about that night. Back then, we barely knew a word in English. What we wouldn't have given to play with the boys on the floor below, but not one of them could understand a word we said. Papa was taking what work he could, tinkering around, and one night she came back with a pile of old trousers and capes. He must have spent 3 weeks hunkered down in the corner with those things. But then, one morning, there this dog was, all wound up and waiting to play. We named him Sirius, after the mutt we left behind. Casper clicked his forefinger and thumb, and Sirius rose on his haunches to beg. He was simpler back then. He couldn't do nearly as many tricks. I love him, said Kathy, and meant it too. Kathy, a note of seriousness had crept into Casper's voice. If you're going to keep him, there's something you have to promise me. I know you, Casper, she said, not knowing if that was true. You'd better tell me what it is first, or I'm liable to find myself in some sort of contract.
Casper took a deep breath before he proceeded. You have to keep him wound.
He saw the way she was looking at him, as if searching for a jest. Sometimes Casper Godman found it hard to be taken seriously. It could be the most vexing thing.
Ever since the day Papa gave him to us, he's never wound down. At first it was because Emil and I always wanted to play with him, but then... He hesitated.
I don't know if I can explain it. You'll think it strange.
Sirius has changed so much since then. Patches have been torn off and taken away. He's had new buttons for eyes. Half of his tail burnt off once. I'll admit I was to blame for that. And we stitched him a new one. But he's never wound down. We wouldn't let it. And his contraption is old. I don't know what would happen if it stopped.
What if he couldn't be wound up again? What if, once he ground to a halt, he was over, he was spent?
Well, he concluded, do you promise?
Kathy said, I do.
And at that Casper turned, as if to hide his eyes. Soon he was hovering in the Wendy House door, ready to disappear into the forest.
Casper, if he did wind down, if that contraption did break, couldn't you just make him a new one?
I don't think it's like that. It would be like somebody opening up your chest and giving you a new heart. How could anything, how could anybody, be the same after that?
He turned back to her, summoning up a smile at last. Things, he decided, had become far too maudlin. Life was for levity, not despair.
Do you think I'm awfully strange, Miss Ray?
Awfully sentimental, perhaps.
Aha, declared Casper. Well, there you have it. For if a toy maker cannot be sentimental, who on this fine earth can?
Casper was correct. She quickly grew restless. The Wendy House was bigger than it had any right to be, but by the end of the second day it was already a prison cell. She spent long hours reading the old catalogues, charting the creations of Papa Jack and his sons across the years. That this could not sustain her forever. By the fall of the third night she knew all about their first winter, when the Emporium was nothing more than the room where the Godman family lived, and the boys from down the hall who told the boys from down the road who told the boys from further afield that here was a family trading toys for winter fuel. She knew about the savings Jacobs Godman built up across that next summer, and how, on the day of the winter's first frost, he made a deal with a fellow migrant, a man named Abram Hassam, to lease the derelict shopfront at the end of Iron Duke Mews. It was Hassan who convinced Jacobs that a stranger could rise up in London, that even a foreigner might prosper. Until then he had been working hard to lose his language, reasoning that English boys wanted English toys, but Hassan convinced him that, if this emporium of his was to succeed, a little exoticism went a long way. People could believe in magic from the frozen East, he said, so long as that East was further afield than Whitechapel or Bethnal Green. So that winter, the rocking horses were painted with the red and green tassels of the Russian steppes, and the bears were arctic white with jet-black eyes. Kathy held up the postcards with which Casper and Emil had capered around the West End, drumming up business while the papa slaved in his shop. It must have worked, because the next year's catalogue proudly declared the Emporium the toast of London town. Papa Jack's toys had garnered such a reputation that the freehold of the building was now his, and the first photographs of the shop floor showed the aisles thronged with enchanted children, and equally enchanted mothers and fathers. That, Kathy supposed, was how the true fortune of the Emporium had been built, by making even grown-ups hanker after toys they might once have had. Leafing through old photographs was distraction enough for the first few days, yet the stretches between Casper's visits were achingly long, and when she spoke to Sirius her voice echoed in the cavernous Wendy House hall.
"I'll bring you more books," said Casper one night, "and games. Papa has chessboards that you can play against themselves, backgammon too. If you treat it right, the wood can remember."
Beat those balls once and you won't beat them in the same way again. Time moved erratically in the Wendy House walls. Sometimes the tedium drove her back to bed in the middle of the afternoon. Often she only knew what hour it was by the fingers rapping on the glass that announced Casper's coming. Once he arrived as she slept, and she woke to find him urgently winding up Sirius, whose innards had started to slow down as she dreamt. "Every night," he was saying as the dog got back to its paws, "every night with your prayers." Kathy swore, there and then, that she would never forget again. By the third week, she was spending too much time standing in the Wendy House door, gazing up into the paper branches. What a thrill it would have been to take just one step, and then one more. But Kathy was true to her word. She made a calendar to keep track of the days, and on it plotted the twists and turns of the baby in her belly. The kicks came with such frequency now, she could catch a heel or a hand and make it squirm inside her. Somewhere along the way, she realized she had not thought of her mother or her father, nor even of Lizzie, in several weeks. Daniel himself was an outline in her mind. He might never have existed were it not for the child turning inside her. Perhaps this was how lives changed, with new families always supplanting the last.
One night, when Casper arrived, she had rearranged the Wendy House floor. The bed she had shifted around, the curtains she had rehung, the nursery had been dismantled and rebuilt in a different corner. "I know what this is," announced Casper, depositing the evening's supplies on the bed. "I've read about it in the annals. This is what happens to polar explorers when they get trapped in their tents. It's a kind of hysteria, the white madness." "It is not hysteria, or madness of any kind. It's... next time I come, I'm likely to find you've built a little temple to one of your new gods. It isn't that bad." "It isn't?" said Casper. "Then I'd hazard you won't mind if I don't linger tonight. I'm in the thick of it in my workshop." At first, eager that he not know how knotted she was feeling inside, Kathy shrugged. And with a smile that was altogether too smug, Casper sauntered out of the door. He had only just breached the line of paper trees when he felt a ball of paper striking him on the back of the head. He paused, pretending it was merely a scrunched-up leaf. But when he strode on, Sirius hurtled to catch him. Only at the dog's insistence did he look back. Kathy was standing in the doorway, pointedly not taking the next step. What spirit she had to indulge in his game of brinkmanship was clearly fading away. "Linger," she said. So, with his air of victory barely concealed, Casper strode back through the Wendy House door. "It's something. It's a start," said Casper. "And, truth be told, it was thinking of you that got me this far." "Me?" Kathy asked, uncertain whether to be flattered or unnerved. "Let me show you." On the ground between them was a small brown suitcase of perfectly utilitarian design. It was so unspectacular, it didn't even have a handle. Casper knelt and opened it up, but it remained as humdrum as ever. All Kathy could see was the black felt of its lining. It was only as Casper stood, dangled one foot over the open case, and plunged it inside that she realized the blackness had unaccounted depths. The Casper's foot seemed to have dropped below the bottom of the case, below even the lining of the floor. Then, after pausing to make sure of his balance, Casper lifted his second foot and planted it alongside the first. Kathy studied him from every angle, while Sirius set up a pillowy hullabaloo. The case had swallowed Casper to the knots of his knees, but by rights it should not have reached his ankles. "Am I going to get a smile?" asked Casper, ignoring the fact that he was wearing the biggest, most inane one himself. "Explain," declared Kathy, determined not to give him the satisfaction even as she battled to contain her surprise. "Well, you already know how Papa can do the most extraordinary things with space. I've been trying to unpick it ever since I was small, but it wasn't until I started thinking about you in your hiding hole here that I started to see. And I was thinking, when you're here, inside the house, how can you ever hope to prove how big the house was outside these walls?" When you're inside, why, it's as big as it feels. And that's all that matters. The perspective has shifted, don't you see? From the inside out, this is what's normal. And it's the same for that little... He flicked a finger airily at Kathy's stomach. Creature in there. To that baby, your body's the whole world. The universe entire. So, with that in mind, I started tinkering. Kathy waved her hand to order Casper out of the suitcase and took it upon herself to stand in his place. There was no unnatural feeling, no sensation that rippled in her ankles as she dropped in and found the bottom, some way below. There was no unnatural feeling, no sensation that rippled in her ankles as she dropped in and found the bottom, some way below. It was the most ordinary thing in the world, and yet still she said, I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. It feels like I've done something real here, something just like my father, punched my way through whatever's been holding me back. Watch and learn, Miss Ray. Watch and learn. By the time this summer ends, I'll have more space inside my packages than you could hope to believe. The real question is, how to sell them. I've been picturing Emporium hiding holes for the perfect game of hide-and-seek, or toy boxes, Kathy announced, at which Casper gave a wolfish grin. Toy boxes, bigger on the inside, so a whole bedroom could be tidied away. Just open it up and cram everything in. Think about that, Casper. What mother wouldn't want a toy box like that? You've a wicked mind, Miss Ray. It is mothers, of course, who hold the purses. Kathy could virtually see the sails piling up in Casper's mind's eye. At once he helped her clamber out of the box, snapped it shut and darted away. I've much thinking to do, too much thinking. He stopped once before the doorway to look back and make his goodbyes. As he did, a new look crossed his face. It seemed he was seeing her for the very first time. It's soon, isn't it? He asked, considering her belly. Soon enough, whispered Kathy. And only after he was gone did she realize quite how soon that was. She had been given the gift of too much time. Too much time to think about it, too much time to wallow in ideas of what birth might be like. Time, she already knew, played tricks in the Emporium. But never as markedly as it did now. The days going by so slowly, but her body changing so fast. Casper came back across the next evenings, always bringing her some new version of his toy. 4 nights had passed by the time he brought her back a prototype toy box. Plain pine inscribed with a tin soldier emblem of Papa Jack's Emporium. It was on the tip of her tongue to ask him to stay that night. But something held her back. Perhaps it was only pride, for Kathy had asked for so little in her life. She faced the emptiness of that night as she had all others, in thinking about the Emporium and its past and trying desperately not to imagine the future. The next night was the first that Casper did not appear. She gave up thinking of him. It was easier said than done. She realized now how eagerly she awaited his visits. And slept early, only to wake an hour, a half hour, a scant few minutes later. And disoriented, stand in the Wendy House door. She spent the next day in solitude. But when Casper did not appear that night, nor the night after that, the feeling of imprisonment became too intense. There were only so many times she could prowl around the Wendy House walls. Only so many times she could go back through the photographs of the old Emporium and search for some detail she had not yet noticed. She did not want to, but when she found herself back at the Wendy House door, it was the most natural thing in the world to set foot outside. And when the world did not end, it was the most natural thing to keep going, over the white picket fence, under the first of the paper trees, up out of the alcove and into the first aisle. Almost immediately the restlessness bled out of her. The knots inside her chest unwound. It was dark in the Emporium, but she wandered along aisles lit by moonlight pouring in from the skylights above, and for the first time in many weeks she felt free. It was intoxicating to be out. She spent an hour in the alcove where the pop-up books had been covered up, ferreting under the dust sheets and going through each book in turn. In the atrium, the Russian rocking horses had been corralled behind a wooden fence, but she stole through and, mindful of her bump, climbed onto the closest she saw. Almost instantly, she could feel the wind in her hair,